Gene Santoro's a jazz and popular music critic for The Nation. In his new book called Highway 61 Revisited, Santoro says you can hear the echoes of jazz almost everywhere, from country music all the way to hip-hop. He told Ann Strangechamps that Louis Armstrong is one of the most influential musical figures of all time.
You know, you can take almost any of the tracks with the Hot Fives or Hot Sevens, for example, and play the solos where he's dancing over bar lines, he's dancing over chord changes, he's spooling out alternative melodies against a framework of, you know, relatively simple stuff, like either the blues or some rudimentary popular tunes. And in the process of that, what gets communicated to the listener is that sense of joy, the sense of instant creativity, the sense of passion and self-bearing, I guess, in a way. I mean, this is Armstrong.
Was this a sound nobody had heard before? I mean, how new
this was
this?
Definitely a sound nobody had heard before. You know, you can look at the relative handful of popular music recordings that existed before Armstrong's time, and you will not hear anything that sounds like that. His sense of time, his sense of melody, the sound, the physical sound of the horn, no one else sounded quite like that. Now, to get to that sound, he did a very American thing, which was ransack everything that he knew to put this together. So you've got bits and pieces of operatic arias, you've got old blues stuff, you've got quadrille lines, you've got, you know, popular songs, you've got everything that he knew is coming out.
So who do you think are the inheritors today, perhaps, of Louis Armstrong's music?
Well, I think the spectrum goes pretty broadly. I mean, it goes from hip-hop to country music. You know, if you listen to Willie Nelson sing, if you listen to Merle Haggard sing, you'll hear the phrasing that you hear in Armstrong's early vocals in the mid to late 1920s. He's the one who invented that phrasing. No one else sounded like that before.
Wait, play that out. How do you hear Louis Armstrong in Willie Nelson?
It's really easy. All you have to do is listen. It's about phrasing and time. You listen to the way that instead of singing on the beat the way that people usually do in pop music, Willie Nelson's moving around like this, kind of like jumping all over the place, putting accents where he needs to put them, and that is Louis Armstrong.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines.
The other thing that I find fascinating is that we tend to think of rock music and jazz as just completely, you know, the opposite ends of the musical spectrum in terms of pop culture. And yet, you know, you point out there have been lots of instances of jazz musicians collaborating with rock artists. I mean, Sonny Rollins worked with the Rolling Stones on at least one album?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and there's many, many, many more examples that are that. I mean, before Jimi Hendrix died, Miles Davis had already finalized plans to record with him. You know, there's an awful lot of stories like that about people working together. Carlos Santana playing with different people. Jerry Garcia from The Grateful Dead playing with Ornette Coleman. And David Murray, who's another jazz saxophone player. I mean, you know, you can unroll a list of hundreds and probably thousands.
So to carry out this kind of musical cross-fertilization we're talking about, it's not just that Jimi Hendrix influenced jazz musicians. Jimi Hendrix himself was influenced by jazz. Because you wrote an earlier biography of the jazz great Charles Mingus. And wasn't Mingus, didn't you point out in that book that Mingus was one of the influences on Jimi Hendrix?
Sure, in a couple of ways. One was that if you listen to the introduction of a Mingus tune called Ease Flat, Oz Flat 2, you'll hear this sliding bass, double stop bass. And then you listen to the beginning of Castles Made of Sand, and you'll hear Jimi Hendrix doing not exactly the same lick, but the same sort of thing as his introduction to that track.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing was that one of Mingus's biggest fans was an English rock group called The Animals. So when they first toured the U.S., when they were in New York, they found out where Mingus was playing and they went down to the club, the Five Spot. As it happened that night, Mingus was having one of his periodic tantrums. Somebody in the audience said or did something, and he got mad. And so he took his bass and he threw it onto the floor and smashed it. Well, this was a $2,200 bass. We're talking about 1965 or 66, so that's a lot of money. At any rate, the bass player from The Animals is a guy named Chaz Chandler. Chaz Chandler, while he was on that same trip in New York, met a guy named Jimmy James, who was playing guitar behind the Fugs. Jimmy James was, of course, Jimi Hendrix. Chandler became his manager, brought him back to England, started up the experience, and voila, there you go.
Now, there's another figure you write about who we haven't talked about yet, a seminal jazz figure, John Coltrane. How does he fit into this story?
Well, Coltrane was an enormous inspiration and influence for a lot of rock and roll people who were thinking bigger than just rock in the 1960s and 1970s. I've already spoken a bit about the Jimi Hendrix connection, but one of the people who really picked up on Coltrane and Miles Davis was Jerry Garcia from The Grateful Dead. In fact, he came out of a bluegrass and folk music background, but there you go. You know, he also loved jazz. When he was working out different parts with Bob Weir, who was the Dead's sort of rhythm guitar player, Garcia used to urge Weir to listen to McCoy Tyner, who was Coltrane's piano player, for understanding how to phrase and chord and when to come in and when to get out behind the solos. The other thing is the way that Garcia himself soloed. The Dead were a very interactive band. I mean, when they were bad, they were very, very bad. And when they were good, they were as good as any good or even better jazz band. Garcia would solo. The other guys would figure out what he was doing and kind of comp around him, and then things would start to move around, and different people would be in front of the band, and other people would be supporting them. You know, you listen to something like Dark Star, which was one of the Dead's most famous cuts and certainly most famous live performance parts. You listen to the introduction to that, the first minute or two, and then you listen to the first couple of minutes of John Coltrane's India, and if you can't see the connection between the two of them, I don't think I could help you.
Listening experience, do you think, to hear the echoes of jazz and to see, you know, America's popular culture, popular musical culture as connected in this way?
I think it should change a number of things. I mean, for one thing, it should make us aware of just how deep and permeating the African-American contribution to all aspects of American culture has been, however subterranean it might seem to us at times, because jazz, after all, is a music that was largely black created, especially in the beginning. And that ethos that we're talking about, that sense of what I've called jazz existentialism, is something that comes very much from that community. And yet it permeates white and Chicano guys like the Grateful Dead and Firesign Theater, who lived and died by that sort of ethos, both in their art and in their outside activities. It's something that migrated all across the culture, and people now just sort of accept it. You know, you hear hip-hop guys talking about keeping it real, but the odds are really good that 99% of them don't know where that idea sort of came from. And that's where it came from.
So it's important to know where you came from?
I think that's one way to look at it, yeah. I think the other way to look at it is that we tend to see our society and our culture in terms of very fragmented subdivisions. A little piece of here, a little piece of there, this slot, that slot. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of this stuff is much more related in very interesting ways that can tell us something about how our larger culture works. You know, jazz is something that, unlike American society, it mostly got big enough to be able to accept a lot of the changes that have happened to America along the way. I mean, if you listen to various aspects of jazz music, you'll hear everything from hip-hop and rock and roll to Latin music to all forms of music being used and recycled and taken apart and put back together in new ways. This is something that I think is one of the best aspects of American culture and one of the, you know, without seeming too maudlin or trite about it, you know, it's part of the hope for American society, I think, that we've produced an art form that is big enough and broad-minded enough to be able to do this says something about the fact that maybe we ourselves as a society will someday be big enough to be able to do it.
Gene Santoro is the author of the book Highway 61 Revisited, and Strange Champ spoke with him.